Thank you, Uncle Jim, for that. We appreciate that very much. I want to be somebody's uncle. Can I do that? You want to echo what Lee said? It has been a great day and it's exciting this morning and looking into the future, so to speak. And today began Pastor Thornton and I sharing some pulpit duties at People's Baptist Church. He is probably just finishing up and on his way back this evening. Their service starts at 6, as ours will next Sunday. And I was there for a time this morning. You'll still see me some on Sunday mornings as well. But we'd appreciate your prayers as we seek to be a blessing. Tonight we stand, I want you just to understand that we stand in front of a wonderful treasure. It's on the other side of a large vault. And just on the other side of that door, if we can spin the right dials and we can turn the right handles, and that very large door can creak open, behind that door is some wonderful treasure. Treasure that will absolutely change your life. It will revolutionize who you are if you avail yourself of the treasure that this vault contains. The great thing about this treasure and the great thing about this vault is the treasure is accessible to you. And what I want you to do tonight, and what I want to provide for you tonight, is I want to see if I can provide for you the combination to unlock the door so you can get in and enjoy the treasures that are there. You'll find these treasures in the 31 chapters of the Old Testament book of Proverbs. And if you want to be turning there, we're going to look at several places in Proverbs. But it contains treasure that will teach us how life works. It, in many ways, is the roadmap or the instruction book for life. It contains for us a wonderful collection of God-inspired wisdom to help us in the practical, everyday, real life, rubber meeting the road issues of life. And we want to help you unlock that, and that's the kind of our subtitle, Unlocking the Treasures of Proverbs. Because Proverbs is a unique book, and that's why I want to spend tonight, and then we're going to spend a few weeks on Sunday nights looking at some of the themes and some of the content of the book. But primarily what I want to do tonight is give you the combination so you can get the vault open. And one of the reasons that gets in our way of understanding and unlocking and getting in and enjoying the treasures is the type of book it is. Well, first of all, I tried to think of some illustrations to help me picture what goes on when I read the book of Proverbs and how could I communicate to you how we can unlock the treasures of this wonderful book. There's been a publishing phenomenon. It's sold in excess of 30 million different volumes of this series of books. And probably most of you have probably at least seen one. Maybe some of you have opened one or you own one in your library. Have you seen all these books for dummies? Have you seen them? They're on every, just kind of every title, every conceivable subject that you want. And there's a book. And the reason that they're so popular is they kind of start with the assumption that you don't know anything about the subject. And it's all right to be ignorant because it's going to correct your ignorance. And like I said, it's been a publishing phenomenon of over 30 million copies of various volumes sold. The interesting thing is, being this is America, right? If something works, someone's going to copy it. So now we have the Complete Idiot's Guide to, you know, we got that whole series of books, which is kind of in the same vein. But it just kind of is simplified, distilled instruction on life or issues it addresses. In some ways, in fact, I was tempted to title this series rather than How Life Works. I was tempted to call it Life for Dummies, but I thought no one would show up if I did that. So I gave it a little more distinguished title. But really, that's what it is. It's just simplified truth in the everyday aspects of life. And sometimes we miss it because we kind of are not used to that kind of approach. There's another reality that I thought of a way to illustrate is because it contains so much and the staccato fashion at which various themes and ideas come at us, these quick little short pairings of statements that seem to kind of be thrown on the page in random fashion, we sometimes have trouble grabbing them. You remember the scene in the old Lucy show where they're trying to put the chocolates off the conveyor belt? You remember that? If you've never seen that, you won't have any idea what I'm talking about. But Lucy and what's her friend's name? I never can remember. Ethel, thank you. Have this job where these little chocolates come in the conveyor belt and they're supposed to package them, and it gets ahead of them, and the boss is coming, and kind of the funniest part of the scene is they start shuffling them in their pockets, in their aprons, and Lucy puts them in her baker's hat. It's all full of chocolates, and the boss is coming, so they start stuffing them in their mouth. And so when the boss comes in, they're standing there with chocolate stuffed everywhere, but the conveyor belt is completely empty, and they're real proud of themselves. So the boss turns around, "You've done such a good job," and she leans over and tells them, "Would you turn up the speed on the chocolates?" You know, and here they all come again. That's kind of how Proverbs approaches. Here's all these wonderful, tasty treasures, but sometimes as they come by on the conveyor belt, we have trouble grabbing them because they come at us in a fashion that we're not very used to. So that's kind of what we want to accomplish tonight is this book. And first of all, you have to understand it is a unique form of literature. Most of us have gotten comfortable with some of the forms of literature in Scripture. Narrative history is very familiar to us. The book of Genesis is narrative history. 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, Nehemiah, Esther. Those are just narratives telling a story. The Gospels are a narrative account of a story. The book of Acts is a narrative account. We're familiar with those. It just tells a narrative history. We're very familiar with the epistles of Paul, where he sets down and writes out a letter for a church. And it's a very logical progression of thoughts, and we can understand the person receiving it or the church receiving it and the intent that it's given, and we can understand that form of literature. We even have some appreciation for apocalyptic literature or prophetic literature. It gets a little deep because of all the imagery, like in Revelation or Ezekiel or some portions of Isaiah or some of the other minor prophets, where these great cataclysmic truths are revealed in very evocative and provocative language that kind of just impresses. And it's very visionary, and it's very visual, and it's very symbolic. But we at least understand, we read Revelation, we understand it's a different kind of literature type that God chose to reveal that portion of Scripture in. But when it comes to poetry, which is what Proverbs is, a form of Eastern ancient poetry, we're not used to the form of it. And I think one of the difficulties we have of unlocking the treasure of Proverbs is understanding the literary form that it's in. And we're just like Lucy trying to grab a few chocolates here and there. And what we grab are wonderful. The problem is there's so many going by that we miss that are treasures that are passing us by. And I want to give you some handles to help you hopefully tonight gather in from this book in a fashion that will help us in a very special way. Well, first of all, we need to start down this path. And the first thing we need to consider is we need to unlock the aim of the book. We need to unlock the aim of the book. In other words, we need to understand the big picture of the book. I've already said that it describes how life works. And maybe we could almost say it how life works most of the time. Look, if you will, in Proverbs 13:4, and this will be just an example for us that we want to look at. It says in Proverbs 13:4, and I'll wait till I hear the papers stop turning. Some of you must have been in Psalms. Okay, you're ready. The soul of a lazy man desires and has nothing, and the soul of the diligent shall be made rich. In other words, that's how life works most of the time. It's the standard operating procedure of life. You and I would understand that a person that works diligently is probably going to be better off than somebody who is lazy and refuses to work. Now, in the grand scope of humanity, do you suppose you could find an exception to the rule? Is there maybe some lazy rich person in the world? I would think that would exist. Is there some hard-working poor person? I think we would understand that. But it's a general principle how life works most of the time. It's the standard. You see, Proverbs aims at describing the ordinary circumstances of life, describing the ordinary life. It does not attempt, it avoids describing the extraordinary life. So when you come to a verse like 13:4, you have to understand, in general terms, in general principles, that's how life works most of the time. You might find exceptions to it, but that is the basic principle. For instance, if you picked up, if you went to the glove box of your automobile, and you pulled out the operating manual for your automobile, it's going to describe for you how your car should operate under normal circumstances. In fact, the assumption is you're going to be driving this road up and down the highway. Now, if you turn in a rerun of the Dukes of Hazzard, you might see a car flying through the air. That's the extraordinary, and that's not how life works most of the time. The owner's manual is not going to describe the extraordinary event of a car flying through the air, which I wouldn't probably recommend you do. But the owner's manual is going to describe the car in its normal operating mode. Proverbs describes life in its normal operating mode. It describes the ordinary, not the extraordinary. Sometimes we approach Proverbs, and I think we almost can, if we're not careful, we can argue with the book. Well, I know an exception to that, or I know a place where that doesn't seem to work, or that doesn't always make sense, and you may be correct. But you have to understand, the aim of the book is describing the ordinary run of life under its normal operating conditions, how life works. And I would think that really the exceptions to the rule are very slim, and I would also say this, the exceptions to the rule usually are not long-term lasting. Yeah, you might see a person who is lazy and has lots of wealth, but probably in the scope of life, the chances are that person who is lazy, probably in the long scope of life or what is passed on to the next generation, that wealth may not always be there. But sometimes we might see a little frame out of the motion picture, but in the long picture, it really does work. So the aim of the book, it describes how life works most of the time. Understand that the aim of the book is to describe the ordinary life. It avoids describing the extraordinary life. Now, let's for a second, I'll talk about the arrangement of the book. Really, you can divide the book with one cut if you want to. Unlock the arrangement of the book. Proverbs has two main sections. The first section is chapters 1 through 9. We're going to call that the dialogue section. And the second section is chapters 10 through 31. We're going to call that the catalog section. All right? In the first 9 chapters, the writer of Proverbs, that we know that the early section appears to be Solomon. In fact, the overwhelming majority of the book appears to be Solomon. There are some in the latter chapters, some Proverbs attributed to others. But predominantly it is a work from the pen of Solomon. The first 9 chapters are a dialogue section. In other words, it is giving in narrative, but still in a poetic sense. In other words, the dialogue section, first 6 chapters, the picture of the instruction is a father instructing a son on living wise. How to live wise. It's father to son. And you just see that again and again and again. If you have chapter 1 available, if you just kind of look down through the verses, you will see that that's where he uses the term my son. Like verse 8 is an example. My son, hear the instruction of your father and do not forsake the law of your mother. Chapter 2, verse 1. My son, if you receive my words and the treasure of my commands within you, so that you will incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding, and so forth. It's from a father to a son. So it's a dialogue. And I want to encourage you, if you think in terms of a moment, the first 9 chapters, put it in the context of fatherly advice or the other dialogues that are given. It'll begin to open up a wonderful understanding of the truth that's there, because you understand the arrangement of the book and how it's arranged. The list of these would continue. Chapter 7 is a drama about the destruction caused by lust. Basically, Solomon tells the story of a man going down the street and he is enticed by a married woman to enter into an adulterous affair. And he describes in great detail how this story unfolds and how he follows her to her house for this illicit encounter. Basically, then it ends with the stern words that the road to her house, the path to her house, is the path to hell. And the destruction that is going to come upon him because he has transgressed God's ways are very stark. So it tells the story in dialogue form. Chapter 8 is a drama of wisdom personified. In other words, it's as if wisdom itself takes on human form and is speaking. And wisdom is speaking in the first person. And wisdom is telling us various aspects that we should know. Chapter 9 is a drama of wisdom and folly personified. In fact, it's pictured as two women. First, there's the woman who is wisdom, and she cries out to all who will hear and calls people to come to living a wise lifestyle. And then later in chapter 9, there's the woman folly who cries out and calls people to live foolishly. And these two personifications of wisdom and folly are pictured as persons, and they call out. So there's that section which is it's various dialogues, father to son, the story of the man heading to destruction because of lust, wisdom personified, folly and wisdom personified in those two women. And then beginning in chapter 10, you have the catalog section, which is what we're most familiar with. It's just verse after verse after verse after verse after verse after verse dealing with the themes of the book. There is no particular arrangement in the sense that it's put in the terms of a drama or different speakers. It's just a catalog of wise proverbial sayings. And it goes from, like I said, from chapter 10 to 31. So as you look at the arrangement, you have to understand these two main sections, and that'll give you some parameters. Secondly, as you try to unlock the book, you have to understand that it has many, many subjects. Many subjects. It details many things. And I brought my list of subjects with me tonight. I forgot how many pages this is. I should look. It's 11 pages of subjects. And I had some help digging this out. But I'll just give you a few. But these, now, as I read some of these, I want you just to kind of take note. This is what makes this book a treasure trove, because these are the issues that you and I deal with. These are the issues our children deal with. These are the issues that our grandchildren deal with. It's real life, okay? It talks about adultery, anger, authority. It talks about borrowing and lending, broken relationships, business relationships, raising children, caring for family, caring for parents, companions and friends, the wise use of counselors, troublesome days, diligence, about the dangers of drinking intoxicating drinks. It talks about the fear of the Lord, gluttony. It talks about gossip. It talks about slander. It talks about greed. It talks about happiness. It talks about hate. It talks about the heart and the human spirit. It talks about honesty, ill-gotten gain, about listening, about love, about loyalty, principles for a nation, principles for parents, proper planning in life and plans. Talks about good and evil, caring for the poor, pride, rebellion, reproof, a good reputation, sin and confession, speech and conversation, who should be trusted, being the right kind of wife, achievements and goals, God's blessings, deliverance from evil, friendship, how to have a happy home, how to have health and longevity, how to have honor and a good reputation, how to enjoy life, peace, how to please God, prosperity and material needs, how to be rescued from trouble, security, wisdom and counsel. And can I stop for a breath? Is that all right? There's many, many more. And I'll probably just give you a few more. It talks about knowledge. It talks about the dangers of pride and the dangers of being quick-tempered and quarrelsome. It talks about how being the right kind of a ruler and how being the right kind of a servant. And on it goes. Probably if you catalog them, and every catalog I've seen have different ways of arranging them because we're trying to arrange God's truth, but dozens at least and hundreds probably would be a more accurate depiction. The issues of life. It has many, many subjects. And these subjects now are the theme of the bulk of the book, and it really is in the first 9 chapters as well, but in catalog fashion in chapters 10 through 31. You have to understand something about Western poetry and Eastern poetry. And this is one of the things that kind of throw us. Western poetry, that's what we're used to, right? Western poetry rotates around sounds. Roses are red and violets are blue. Can't think of the rest of it, but it's got to rhyme with blue, right? Like, you know, marry me and say I do or something. I don't know. But it sounds good. It rotates around sounds and rhythms. To a Jew in Solomon's day, if you tried to do a poem like Roses Are Red and Violets Are Blue, he'd probably laugh at you because of how simplistic that is. He'd probably say, that is really dumb. I mean, what's the attraction of just having stuff sound good. Well, we understand that poetry is more than just sounding good, but it is the blending of ideas. But we put it into a form that has the right rhythm and the right pace and the right sound to our ears. Eastern poetry, Hebrew poetry, it rotates around ideas. It rotates around ideas that are just woven through a proverb, through a chapter, or through a section. And it's interesting, if you take it, as an example, we're going to look at Proverbs 12 for just a moment, if you want to go there. We're just going to look at three themes that you see woven through Proverbs 12, just to kind of give you a flavor of how this works. The first theme in this example from Proverbs 12 is the theme of hard work. The theme of hard work, and you'll see it repeats. Proverbs 12, and look in verse 11. He who tills his land will be satisfied with bread, but he who follows frivolity is devoid of understanding. Talking about the theme of hard work. It repeats then in verse 24. The hand of the diligent will rule, but the lazy man will be put to forced labor. Look in verse 27. The lazy man does not roast what he took in hunting, but diligence is man's precious possession. So in the catalog of these proverbs, in their poetry, what was clever and what was captivating in their style of poetry was, as you read through these things, all of a sudden that idea pops up again. And then we have some more cleverly arranged words, and suddenly that idea comes back around again. And then we put it together, and it comes back around again. It rotates around a theme or an idea that repeats itself. A second theme you see in the same psalm is the subject of words, or the proper use of speech. Look in verse 6. Where it says, the words of the wicked are lie in wait for blood, but the mouth of the upright will deliver him. Look in verse 13. The wicked is ensnared by the transgression of his lips, but the righteous will come through trouble. Look at verse 14. A good man will be satisfied with good by the fruit of his mouth, and the recompense of a man's hands will be rendered to him. Verse 17. He who speaks the truth declares righteousness, but a false witness deceit. And that goes all the way through verse 19 about speaking the truth. Verse 22, lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but those who deal truthfully are His delight. Verse 23, a prudent man conceals knowledge. In other words, he doesn't say too much, but the heart of the foolish proclaims foolishness. Verse 25, the righteous should choose his friends carefully. That's 26. Anxiety in the heart of man causes depression, but a good word makes it glad. See how that just rotates right through. We've had two themes that have just been interwoven through this one chapter. Righteous character is the third theme you see in this particular one. There's others, but this is all we're going to do. Look where he mentions righteous character, like in verse 2. A good man obtains favor from the Lord, but a man of wicked intentions he will condemn. Verse 3, a man is not established by wickedness, but the root of the righteous cannot be moved. Look at verse 10. A righteous man regards the life of his animal, but the wicked tender mercies of, the wicked are cruel. Verse 13, the wicked is ensnared by the transgression of his lips, but the righteous will come through trouble. Verse 21, no grave trouble will overtake the righteous, but the wicked shall be filled with evil. Verse 26, the righteous should choose his friends carefully, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. Verse 28, in the path of righteousness is life, in the pathway there is no death. Have you got another theme just interwoven through it? And where it gets very clever, go back to verse 13. If you have these three themes just kind of rotating through the proverb in the poetical form of the Old Testament, there are places where the two threads will intersect each other with the same truth. Verse 13 talks about lips, and it also talks about righteousness, two of the three themes we've looked at. The wicked is ensnared by the transgression of his lips, but the righteous will come through trouble. So those places where the author can take these rotating ideas and then bring them together into a common proverb, in their mind was very clever and very compelling and very memorable. So when you read a proverb and you think, well, I talked about that, but then we go on to the next subject, and the next subject, and the next subject, and then we're back to that subject, and it's just like all these chocolates coming down the conveyor belt. Understand that was how God inspired these, particularly Solomon, to write these proverbs in a form that would communicate to their day. Here's the beauty of it. The form that God chose to communicate to the literary poetical style of their day, this of rotating ideas rather than rotating sounds and rhythms, the great thing is, if you take a poem that sounds good in English and you translate it into another language, because the cleverness was in the sound and now it's in another language, you're in big trouble. I was given a CD a while back, and there's a particular track on the CD of the performer singing Danny Boy, you know, old Danny Boy, you know. And I recognize the tune, except the singer is singing in German. Of course, I don't speak German, so I don't know how clever it was, but I'm just thinking it's just not going to work as it should. But the poetic means that God chose to encapsulate His wisdom in the book of Proverbs was Hebrew poetry form, which rotates around ideas that when you do translate it into another language, the ideas are preserved. It doesn't matter if it doesn't sound right, because that wasn't the point. The point is, the ideas are what is important. And God chose a literary form so that us English-speaking people in the 21st century can still appreciate God's truth, and any people group in any language pocket of the world can appreciate His truth, because God chose the right form that it would be universal and translatable to any people in the world. If you put it in our form of poetry, it would be a mess when you translated it into other languages. So that's some about the arrangement. And it has three main structures, and this will help you, I hope, as well. And then we're going to do a little practice session, and then we'll be done for our introduction tonight. But Proverbs, in this arrangement, it has three main structures. Three main structures. And for an example, I want you to go to Proverbs 18, just as a place just to practice a little bit. Proverbs 18 is going to be our practice section for tonight. But basically, there are three main structures to the Proverbs, all right? And this is kind of the way I have kind of got it in my mind. If you find some other way to say the same thing, that's fine. Or if you find, you know, well, this verse doesn't fit any of those three categories, that's okay. But this is just kind of basic structure, if you will, all right? First of all, there are three main structures. There are those that complete, those that compare, and those that contrast. All right, that's the three main structures, and we're going to illustrate those in just a moment from some of the verses in Proverbs 18. But let's talk about what these mean. Most of the Proverbs are a pair of sayings joined together. Those that complete, usually it makes a statement, and then the second statement completes the first statement. It's, in other words, it completes what went before. It just makes a statement and then adds more to it. Okay? Those that compare, it makes a comparison or tells how they are like something else. It's not so much the first and the second compare each other, but they make two statements that compare truth to something else. In other words, it draws a comparison, a picture. And those that contrast, usually the pairing is this. One will make a statement and then a contrasting statement to show how those two statements are unlike. All right? So some of you are still scratching your head. Let's do a little practice, and this will help, all right? First of all, examples from Proverbs 18. Let's talk about the completion statements, those that complete the statements. And we're not going to look at all those verses, but I want to just pick a few selected ones just to show you how this works. Verse 3, here's a completion statement. When the wicked comes, contempt comes also, and with dishonor comes reproach. Note the word "and" there. That's kind of your clue to being this kind of a structure. In other words, the first statement is made, when the wicked comes, contempt also comes. People will have contempt for those that are treating them wickedly. And with dishonor comes reproach. It just completes the statement. Verse 15 would be another verse that gives an example. This is a positive one. That was a negative one. The heart of the prudent acquires knowledge, and the ear of the wise seeks knowledge. He makes a statement and then adds to it with the second statement. All right, the heart of the prudent acquires knowledge, and the ear of the wise seeks knowledge. It all is in the same theme, but it just kind of adds to it. Verse 21 would be another example. Death and long life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit. He just completes the statement. In other words, he's talking about... I lost my place. Was that 21? Yeah. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. In other words, the tongue has great power, and those who love the power that it brings will eat of its fruit. There's going to be natural results from it, if you want to say it that way. Look at verse 22. There's another one that completes. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. So he's speaking particularly to men. If you have found a wife, he says that's a good thing. And not only is it a good thing, it is a gift. She is a gift from God. Favor of God. Completes that. You wives like that, don't you? All right? Haven't memorized that one. But it's true, because it's God's truth. Let's look at some comparative ones. In other words, where it takes the terms and compares it to something else. Verse 10 will be one of our examples we'll look at. The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe. The comparison here is the name of God is compared to a mighty fortress where you're safe. Very simple, isn't it? It's a comparison. Verse 11 would be another example. The rich man's wealth is his strong city, and like a high wall in his own esteem. Now, it might be some foolish, false protection. That might be kind of where he's going here. And I think it probably is. But the comparison is made in that sense. So, some verses complete. Some compare the truth to other things. And then there are those that contrast. In other words, it draws a contrast between two things that are not alike. Verse 2 is an example of a contrast in verse 18. Chapter 18, I should say. The fool has no delight in understanding, but, there's your key word, there's the contrast, in expressing his own heart. In other words, here's the contrast. A foolish person just wants to tell you what he knows, and what he does, he has no delight in getting other people's knowledge, but what he delights in is giving you his opinion. The contrast is his opinion rather than him acquiring knowledge. Verse 12 is another example. Before destruction, the heart of a man is haughty or prideful. And before honor is humility. The contrast here is between haughtiness and humility and between honor and destruction. So the contrast is, if you want to be honored, be humble. If you want to be destroyed, be prideful or be haughty. It's as simple as that. They contrast one with the other. Okay? Well, hopefully that'll give you a few things to put your ideas on. And I would encourage you to think that way and think about, is this a comparison? Is this a contrast? Is this a completion? Is this a dialogue, a catalog? Is it that theme rotating through? You need to know all those things, but where we want to get is, we want to get to the application of the book. How do you take God's truth and plug it into your life? And that's what I want to get to. And we're just going to do a couple practice, and then from here on out, when we look at the various themes in the book of Proverbs, and we're not going to cover all of them, I will not live long enough. But the ones that we look at selectively, we're going to try to apply this pattern to it so that we can put God's word to work in our lives. The application of the book. And there's three steps to it, and I'll just go through them, and then we're going to give you two examples, and then we're done. Unlocking the application of the book. First of all, we need to find the main idea. In other words, just identify in that verse or those section of verses or the themes rotating through that particular chapter of Proverbs. What's the big idea? What is the main thing God's trying to get across? Secondly, you need to find the results of the issue presented. What are the results of that? And Proverbs is a book of results. If you do this, this will happen. If you don't do this, this will happen. It's very practical that way. Practical results are, first of all, we're talking about, there are practical results, and then there are spiritual results. You need to identify. Some are just, if you're lazy, you're probably not going to be rich. If you work hard, you'll probably have stuff for your family. That's just a practical result. There are spiritual results, that one we just looked about being haughty can lead to destruction. That's a spiritual result. So there's spiritual results, practical results. Some of them are, sometimes they kind of blend and blur together, and that's okay. We don't want to slice it with so fine a blade that we understand it, but we don't apply it. We'll just make sure that we look this way. So find the results of the issue presented. And thirdly, find the decision points from the issue presented. And that's where we have to take that issue after we've studied it and say, what do I need to decide today in my life to do or not to do? What should I avoid? What should I accept as normative for me? All right? Let's go to chapter 17 and let's practice. Take a couple verses here and practice this application process. All right? And you see them there in front of you, and we'll keep those in mind. Find the main idea. Find the results, practical and spiritual, and find the decision points from the issue presented. Chapter 17, look in verse 4. 17:14. The beginning of strife is like releasing water. Therefore, stop contention before a quarrel starts. All right? If you look in verse 19, you'll see it's the same main idea rotated again. All right, down in verse 19. He who loves transgression loves strife, and he who exalts his gate seeks destruction. And if you'll bring those two verses up, please. I love the way the NIV says the first one. Starting a quarrel is like breaching a dam. So drop the matter before a dispute breaks out. And that's literally what it's meaning. You know, once a dam is breached, what's going to happen? It's going to get out of control. Like the levees in Louisiana. Once they were breached, they started eroding, and then the whole system failed and flooded the city. That's what he's talking about. He says, if you start a quarrel, it's like breaching a dam. It's just going to get out of control. So what you want to do is you want to drop a matter before it gets out of control. The second verse is similar. He who loves a quarrel, if you love getting in an argument with people, if you were an argumentative person, you're going to be a person who also loves sin, because arguing generally leads to sin. By the way, those are the big pictures, all right? Let's go to the big picture. What's the big picture from these two verses? Arguments can have damaging results. That's the big picture from those two verses. Arguments can have damaging results, all right? What are the results practically here? The practical one, once an argument starts, it tends to get bigger. Okay? That's the practical result. And you know that to be the case. You're in an argument with somebody, and they argue a little bit, and you argue back, and they argue a bit, and the volume goes up, and the intensity goes up, and the blood pressure goes up, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. It's just natural. It's a natural, practical result of arguing. Secondly, the spiritual result, and we've already talked about it, an argument invites sin. When people in the heat of an argument are arguing with each other, eventually the motives are going to get warped, and the language is going to get intense, and usually we're going to say things that later we're going to regret that we said, or maybe we're going to use vocabulary which a believer ought not use, or whatever the case is. If you're in an argument, you're inviting sin, because it's very likely that that's going to take place. That's the spiritual results, okay? The big picture, arguments have damaging results. If you love quarrel, you're inviting sin. If a dam is breached, it's going to get bigger. So drop the matter before it gets out of control. So what's the decision point? This is my decision point, all right? You can write your own, but this is, as I've processed this, this is what I came up with. When tempted to begin an argument or continue one, consider the consequences and drop the matter. That's the decision point. When I'm tempted to get into an argument, when I'm tempted to just let it fly, when I'm tempted to see the dam breach, and when I would just love to get into a quarrel over this particular issue, I know you're going to find this really hard to imagine for me, that would ever be the case, but just trust me on this. When you're tempted that, I need to, at that particular moment in time, consider the consequences of what I'm about to engage in. It's going to get bigger, not smaller, Jess. It's going to invite sin rather than righteousness. Consider that. And then I love what it says in verse 14. I'm reading it in the New King James here. But the beginning of strife is like releasing water, breaching a dam. Therefore, stop contention before a quarrel starts, or drop a matter. You ever play tug of war? Question. If you're playing tug of war with one other person, how many people does it take to drop the rope to end the game? this is a quote, and I don't have the proper attribution to it, but this is a quote that I found. In a two-person game of tug-of-war, it only takes one person dropping the rope to end the game. So if you're in an argument with somebody, or you're about to get into an argument, you know the feeling. You've learned it, haven't you? I'm about to get into an argument here. It's going to be a good one. It's going to be a big one. I need to consider the results, the consequences, and most often I can be the person with the rope in my hands to just release it and let it go. Now, because most of the things we fight over aren't all that important things to fight over. And usually if you can let go of the rope and deal with your problems in a more mature fashion, in a more controlled fashion, you can actually get some things done in relationships that are positive. You see how that works? What's the big idea? What are the practical results, the spiritual results? What's the decision point? Let's try one more. Go to chapter 12 for just a moment. In chapter 12, 26, and then we're going to look at 13:20. The idea rotating here is proper choosing of friends and choosing friends wisely. Those of you that are parents, you've warned your children about this and didn't know you're quoting Proverbs unless you're quoting these verses. You know, you got to watch out that you don't want to hang around the wrong crowd, the wrong people, the wrong influences. You want to hang around people that are encouraging you and bringing you to the right point. And you want to be a person that positively influences over those things we tell them. In 12:26, we read, "The righteous should choose his friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray." The righteous should choose his friends carefully, because the way of the wicked, if you hang around wicked people, it's going to lead people astray. 13:20, "He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will be destroyed." There's a contrast. That's a contrasting verse. If you walk with wise men, you'll be wise. If you're companion of fools, it's going to lead to very damaging, destructive consequences in your life. So what's the big picture? Here's how I processed it. Big picture, we should exercise discernment in relationships. Am I hanging around wise people, people that are positive influence, or people that are leading me astray? Are people hanging around me? Am I influencing them for right, or am I spreading seeds of discord or complaining or discontent or whatever? It works both ways. What are the results? The practical result, you gain wisdom from being around wise people, having wise friends. That's just practical. You're around people that are wise, you're going to pick up some of their wisdom. You're going to absorb some of their philosophy and their thinking and their approach to life. The spiritual results, you see in the second verse, you can be negatively influenced by the wrong friends. That's not real profound. We all know that, but here it is encapsulated in God's truth. And then we have the decision points. Here's what I came up with. Decision point one, I should evaluate how I am influenced by others and choose my friends carefully. Just evaluate who's influencing whom and which direction are we influencing them. Now, be careful. This is just the normal standard issue life. This is not the extraordinary. This does not mean that Christians should isolate themselves from others or should isolate themselves from lost people. But if I'm around lost people and I can influence them for Christ, that's positive. If I'm around lost people and they're influencing me for evil, then we need to pull back from that. And we just have to evaluate where the influence is going. Secondly, I should surround myself with wise friends as well as strive to be one. So the decision points are I need to do some evaluation. Who's influencing whom? How am I influencing others? How are they influencing me? And then should seek with God's help to surround myself with wise people. That's a very simple way to process it, but I want to encourage you to begin thinking that way and begin processing this book, because you stand right at the door of a wonderful vault filled with great treasure about how life works. It's very practical and covers all the issues that you and I are concerned about. And I want you to use some of these tools to spin the dial and open the vault and use them. We've tried for the last several years in our home. There's 31 chapters in Proverbs, which makes it real convenient just to read a proverb a day. And we've practiced that. mean, I'm sure there's, I know there's been days that we have missed, but that's been our normal practice. Today's the 23rd, read in Proverbs 23 this morning, and so forth. And it just is a habit of staying in the book. If you come up to a 30-day month, you can either read two chapters or just read chapter 31 every other month. It really doesn't matter, okay? In February, just don't worry about it, okay? But the point is, get in the habit of reading this book and extracting from it the precious treasures of God's wisdom. And it will radically change your life. And I'm looking forward to these next few weeks as we just kind of tear into some of these themes and just ask the question together, are we willing, are you willing to open the vault and find the treasures that are in this book? Father, thank you for allowing us just to, in a few moments, introduce this wonderful book that contains your wonderful truth. Father, we need to be wise people. We are so easily influenced. We are so easily led astray. Lord, our gullibility sometimes shocks us. But Father, we need to find your instruction book for life. We need to find out how life works. And Lord, you've packed it into the 31 chapters of this wonderful book. I pray that you'll make it a precious treasure to us. And the truth that we glean from it will be a precious treasure. Lord, I pray that you'll help all of us just make a commitment to staying in this book of wisdom and learning from it. Help us to process it in this fashion or some other practical fashion, that we'd find the right ideas, see the results, and make the right decision points, empowered by your Spirit. Lord, might you be continuing to mold us and make us into people that really enjoy life working as it should. Because, Father, we're following the blueprint that you've provided for us. Grant us your blessing in that, we pray, in Jesus' name.